interview with Douglas Foskett of Side 2. So this is reminding you of an anecdote.
Yes. We had, or I had experimented with syllabic, with literal notations, with the packaging scheme, and I devised one system which meant that the facets could be indicated by capital letters and the terms within the facets by small letters. And as I worked with this and talked to people about it, it became obvious that where a three-letter symbol could be pronounced, it would be pronounced. And so I came up with the idea, why not make it all notation pronounceable, these three-letter symbols pronounceable, so that instead of having, say, B-U-D-S-U-R-K-A-B, you'd just say bed, sir, cab, and that would be that. And it would be different from 6 to 8.7919823, which is the Dewey for packaging. Anyway, I put that into effect sometime later, but I don't think it really lasted, because of course you've reduced your size of your notation considerably if you introduce a vowel into the second place. A nice thought though, I like that one. But anyway, to get back to the anecdote, it turned out, and there was the problem, that in a faceted scheme, the most specific topics are right at the end of the schedule. So that if you start A, B, C, D, E, the most specific topics begin with X, Y, Z, and not with A, B, C. So in a document subject, you would have X, Y, Z, N, B, G, A, B, C, and so on, instead of A, B, C, X, Y, Z, and so on. Reverse order, in fact. This worried me a lot, and I couldn't think how to overcome this. And I went and looked at a collection, which was more of an archive collection, stored in metal cabinets, big drawer, four-drawer metal cabinets. And that had been notated, or had been arranged, by a Japanese who naturally read from right to left. And I didn't bother any more about that. So that was that. And then the packaging thing came up later with the European Packaging Federation. And they asked me to, they saw the thing, scheme that I'd done for the metal box registry stuff, the correspondence, lab reports, and very specific topics, and that was going along in full swing, and the printed version came out just as I left Metal Box, but it was carried on by John Rippon, who took over my place at Metal Box, and I told you became a member of the council of the Institute of Information Scientists, in spite of having no science degree, but a very good chap. Now that's dead. Terrible.
Now, well, this is kind of the CIT, so you folk are making up these classifications.
Yes.
And they are, in fact, being used. When did Ranganathan come over?
Ranganathan came over in 1948.
48?
Yes. At the invitation of the Society for Visiting Scientists in London. And he gave a very good lecture at ASLIB, in sort of sponsored by the Society of Visiting Scientists, and it was called a self-perpetuating scheme of classification, and it was published in a very early volume of JDoc after the war. And then the JDoc merged with another publication, which was the publication of the British Society for International Bibliography, BSIB.
Pollard and Bradford.
Pollard and Bradford, yes. And then, of course, Hawke Fairthorne and Erkin, who were also in the BSIB. Yes, that was in the early days of Erkin's career.
Because Erkin was in the Science Museum?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where was Old Fairthorne? Was it the
RA in Farnborough? In Farnborough,
yes.
But he had two, I remember this very clearly, he had two lectures published in the BSIB. Proceedings, I think it was called.
Yes, the SID Proceedings.
During the war. Yeah. And one was called The Mathematics of Classification, and the second one was called The Classification of Mathematics. And they were both in the same volume of the SID Proceedings. And did you ever meet Bob Fairfield?
Yeah, no.
Oh, he was a god.
Yeah.
Oh, a wonderful chap. And of course, a very, very eminent mathematician who had without doubt made considerable contributions during the war, though nobody would know about them, because they were the RAE in Royal Aircraft Establishment.
Yeah.
And so Bob Fairthorne, of course, was one of the first members of the CRG as well, and he and Vickery were very good in cooperation an exchange of views.
Was Vickery's background as a chemist?
Yes,
yes,
yes, yes. He had been in industrial chemistry during the war, and then he had got the job of librarian at Acres, ICI Acres, which was named after Sir Wallace Acres, who'd been the director of research for ICI for many years. And rather a sort of good thing for ICI to set up such a place. Pure research, and a lot of their advances, of course, came from my Acres. And
coming back to Ranganath and that lecture, Fairthorne and Urquhart were, you were mentioning,
in the context of Bob, both.
Yeah.
Ranganath came over and gave this lecture, and of course was entertained by Wells, Jack Wells, at his house in Ilford. And he invited a number of the other members of staff to meet Ranganathan at his house. And I remember very vividly Ranganathan demonstrating a facet analysis of the subject of knitting. Knitting all about all these library girls sitting around.
Oh, I see.
A gog, you see. Indeed, in a classification of knitting. And then he came to a CRG meeting and had great discussions with Eric Coates, of course, who was then the chief subject cataloguer of BNB, and produced his, well, I still think is probably the best book on cataloguing ever written. Subject headings and procedures, yes. And that should be reprinted, really, although I think, whether we'll be, because Eric got bumped down with his old system of ordering. Shame. But anyway, he's still there,
Jack's still there, I'm still there, Derek, a language alas, has just died, and we shall miss him very, very severely, because he was a very strong advocate for classification in the humanities, which was his book. You know, he produced, Vickery, myself and Langridge produced the three books, Classification Index in Science, Social Science and Humanities, that made a trilogy, and he was very good on the theoretical basis of subject analysis, very much influenced by the work of modern professors of education, professors of the philosophy of education, who have got their own ideas about the grouping of natural phenomena and human products as part of natural phenomena. Forms of knowledge was Derek's theme, and he reckoned, I can't really tell you accurately because I would need to have the paper in front of me.
But so let's come back to
one. Yes, let me just give you one instance of the sort of, well, the one instance of Derek's approach. He would say that whereas most classification people would take a book on the history of science and would say, well, obviously that's the book that goes with the science books, Derek would say, no, it doesn't go there at all.
It's a history book. History is a particular form of knowledge, and it's not science. So it must go with the history of books, and the history of science, and the history of medicine, and the history of art, and the history of this and that, are all in the form of knowledge known as history. That, I think, is an epitome of Derek's approach. He had about half a dozen, six or eight of these forms
of knowledge.
Science was one. History was one. And anyway, then that was the, to get to the back to the point of the CRG, the crucial point was when all of us compilers of these special schemes, we had all come across the one same problem. We all needed a reservoir of the rest of knowledge to draw. Like in packaging, there is the facet called PAX, which is anything from aspirins to battleships. Now we didn't want to have a classification, I didn't want to have a classification of the whole of everything as one facet of my classification scheme. When I came to do education, which has been published as part of the Bliss scheme, when I came to do education, the subject of the curriculum is a similar case. Anything can be taught. So we don't want a classification of everything in one facet of the education classification. What we need is to say, go and draw on this, what we called an Ur classification, which was a vast conglomeration of every term you could think of, but not necessarily a classification of it. So what we, the conclusion of all this was that we needed a new, good, general classification scheme, which was not simply a collection of specialist schemes. It had its own internal structure and methods of analysis and synthesis and use. So that's how we all came to be involved with the new edition of Bliss. And Jack Mills was teaching at the Northwest Poly, as it was, and became the University of North London, and he got a lot of, he used to teach his students that way, by getting them to make their own schemes in their own fields of interest, where their degree or whatever it might be. He did, Jack, I don't think Jack produced one scheme of his own. Eric did a lot of work on additions to Dewey. I don't know if you remember, but for many years at one point when Eric was still there, Eric Coates was still there, the BNB developed a technique of enlarging Dewey by brackets brackets one, and then verbal extension. And the verbal extensions enabled the chain indexing procedure to be carried out automatically, better than using the notation, which is what Rangnell's technique did, of course. So then we had, I happened to see in one of the scientific magazines, typed like Chemical Engineering News, say, a note that NATO was interested in a new classification of the sciences. So I wrote to NATO and said, sort of strange that you should come to this conclusion. We in the classification research group have reached this conclusion ourselves, but we have no resources. So they invited me over, and I went to NATO in Paris and saw their head of science, and I persuaded him that we could do something if we had the money, and he gave us £5,000. So we called a conference, and there was a little pamphlet, I don't know whether you will have seen that, there was a little pamphlet called something like Classification for a General Index Language. Well, I've got a copy of that somewhere. It was published by the Library Association, in which we outlined our thoughts about the relationship between specialist schemes and general schemes, and what the structure of a general scheme could look like, and what sort of techniques would be needed. So then we used this £5,000 You may like to delete this, but it will be interesting for you to refer back to. We then recruited an excellent girl called Helen Pates, who had been a student at UCL, was a classic graduate.
Did you say Bates or
Pates? Pates, Pates, yes, mm. Helen Pates. And she wrote two or three really good papers, including one on the classification of politics, which was subsequently incorporated into the new risk classification. And she really was excellent, and then she went and got married. And she married a fellow graduate of UCL, and they moved to Cambridge, and she said she couldn't carry on. And so this was only 6 months into our scheme, and of course £5,000 in those days was quite a decent sum. We could afford to employ somebody for a year.
Oh, really?
Full time, you see. And who did we get but bloody Derek Austin? Who at that time was employed by the BNB and was rather favoured by Jack Wells. And he didn't know anything about fastid classification. I can remember him coming to my office in the Institute of Education and sitting there and having a lesson on facet analysis and that sort of thing. And what did he do? He went and off and invented Precy and made an internationally famous name for himself out of our money, but to no advantage of our scheme whatsoever. And where's Precy now? Gone with the wind, which is what it was. I was absolutely, you can imagine, I got into that. I had myself organized this 5,000, right? And I could not deviate. I could not make him deviate from this path, which is, of course, an alphabetical system.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody thought it was the bee's knees, and it's dead. Nobody knows. Never heard of it now.
No, it was so prominent though, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. And I think, Tony gave some time to it in his subject approach. But that's where that went. And now, if we had £5,000 now, or the equivalent.
You need the equivalent,
yes. Yes. We could finish the Bliss scheme.
Yeah.
It's really heartbreaking for me, that.
Right. So, nothing came from it then that you could send back to NATO?
No, nothing. We sent back the conference proceedings, and the LA also published a bigger research pamphlet number 2, which contained quite a lot of CRG minute stuff. So we sent that, and they got something out of it, but what they didn't get was the new general classification of the sciences, which is almost complete now, which having been done with everybody's part-time.
Right. So this work on Bliss, the second edition of Bliss, has been going on then for quite a long time.
Yeah, a long time.
Is it in any general use now?
Oh, yes. Mm. Yes, there is a Bliss Classification Association.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's much in use in the States.
You never hear about it in the States.
No, you never hear about it, although he's an American, of course.
Yes, originally, yes.
Astonishing that, but I think that it's... I've got a little theory of my own that the basic American philosophy of life is the exaltation of the individual above any systems. Therefore, alphabetical subject cataloguing is the natural library concomitant of that philosophy.
Metcalfe's specific entry.
Specific entry, yes, yes. How specific is specific, yes. Yes. That title of Don Swanson's paper nearly came into my head of just now. It's gone again. It was something like poverty of information, or...
Oh, there's a recent paper on not the fallibility, but the there were inadequacies or something. There was a series of, and he numbered a number of inadequacies of information.
Yes, yeah. That sounds like that, but it wasn't recent. It could have been a good long time ago.
For most of us, you know, Ranganathan was a name and very important and influenced people's thinking. And, you know, in the case of Metcalfe, by way of opposition and calumny.
Yeah.
And the CRG by way of stimulation and so on.
Yes.
But again, I think he's dropping out of sight, especially in America, from the younger generation.
Well, and I know what you mean. But I think he has maybe achieved the fate of all the best inventions, that he has become embedded so much in the consciousness that people have forgotten that he invented it.
Mm.
I always found that talking to the people like the packagers and the occupational safety people and people like that, I always found that they could understand it immediately, the facet of analysis, both the material, the energy, the historical time, the geographical location, and the end product. And of course, the systems theory of von Bertalanffy and Erwin Laszlo and those people, there's an American in Chicago whose name I can't remember at the moment, who also has joined in this. There's a lot of books on general systems theory.
Yeah.
Well, it's facet analysis, absolutely. And as I wrote a paper myself for an Indian Library Association conference years ago called The Personality of the Personality Facet, in which I said that here is general systems theory. And general systems theory centers around the idea of the whole being greater than the sum of its parts, in short. And that's what facet analysis is. And the personality of any subject field is the end product in technology. Technology is an easy way to demonstrate this. Of course, Derek was very good at that in the humanities, the more academic subjects, which I'm for, well, in his classification of the humanities, he does this. And he used it in his jazz classification, for example. And so I think that the idea of these categories of material, I mean, as old as the Greeks, but Ranganathan was the first one to demonstrate that you could do it with terms in a system of classification. And I think that it's got so much embedded into people, they may not call it facet analysis, but the technique of subject analysis in that way, that people take it for granted if they're interested, and that's what they do.
Yes, I'm sure these object-oriented databases, or whatever they're called, employ a process very similar.
Yes, cruder, but similar. Yeah. And so I wish we could get into that sort of area, but if I were 20 years younger, that's where I would be. I would be doing these classifications all over the place and putting them on the internet and have a website saying class.com or whatever.
Yeah, you should think of it. It's never too late, Douglas.
Well, I've got other things, like my ancestor research. I've got myself back to the Civil War, our Civil War. There were Foskets involved in the Civil War, and there's a village that I just visited called Foscott in North Buckinghamshire, Foscott Manor.
Unfortunately, I don't think I am entitled to own it, because my grandfather in that era was the last son, not the first. And I take the photograph of it.
So you have it sold now.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of...
That's right.
So what about, just coming back to Ranganathan, and I don't know why I'm dwelling on Graham at the moment. So what was he like? I mean, as a personality?
Oh, he was tremendous fun.
Was he?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. He was full of laughter. He had all the arrogance of genius, I suppose I would say, and not so much with us, but with his Indian friends and colleagues, especially those who were on his staff. He behaved in a what you can only call an imperial way. But he was absolutely dedicated to librarianship, and particularly classification.
Mm.
And he has a very fine son called Yogeshwar, who is an engineer, lives in Luxembourg. Excellent chap.
Luxembourg.
Yeah. He really is married to a Swiss person.
Mm.
Anyway, a continental European girl. They have a son. And so Ranganathan has a grandson, grown-up grandson, and in fact, at this very conference in Delhi, Ranganathan's grandson came and spoke about his grandfather.
Oh.
Yes, it was really lovely. I wish that had been recorded somehow to hear the young man, whose name I really, again, escapes me, talking about his grandfather and how he used to play with him as a little boy.
Yeah.
And I remember one time when I was in Geneva at the ILO, Ranganathan lived in Zurich for 2 years,
yeah.
And I visited him there, and Yogeshwar was there, his son, and he took us around, drove us around Zurich while he was there, and it was very interesting and engaging to see Yogeshwar putting his old man in his place. Pa, he called him.
Yeah. But I take it was the son was driving the car, not Ranganathan.
Yeah. No, Ranganathan would never have it. Ranganathan would go like that and expect the car to be there to take him. But utterly dedicated, he lived a most austere life, like Gandhi, who he admired greatly, of course, and never spent anything on himself. And I forget, I think it might have been Bernard Palmer who told me this from his recollection of the home in the war, that one day Ranganathan came home from his work when Yogeshwar was a little boy, and on the wall Yogeshwar had written, "Librarians may be very good for humanity, but they're not much good for their family." I don't know whether those are the exact words, but pretty nearly the exact words, yes.
We don't have an account of Ranganathan's response.
No, no, I'm sure he would have laughed, laughed. But, now, to come back to the point, Yogeshwar has now written A Life of Ranganathan. It's not yet published, and perhaps I could ring him up and let you know.
I'd be very interested to see it.
You would.
You would
indeed.
Not from any sense of having any role in publication. I mean, I presume, does he have a publisher?
I don't know.
No. But just out of general interest in the subject matter.
From what you're doing?
Yeah.
I'm sure it will be most useful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
joy. Arriving back.
I'm sharp hearing, don't I?
Yeah. I used the computer printer.
Mm.
And I've made some contributions to the book, much as we've been talking about now.
Yeah.
And I just don't know. I expect that it may be published by his own or his mother's trust. You know, Ranganathan devoted all his money to the Sarada Ranganathan Trust.
Yes, I've seen that.
That's his wife, Sarada Ranganathan. Mm. And it was, in fact, his second wife, because he was married in childhood, as the Indian.
Oh, arranged marriage.
Arranged marriage, yes. I don't know what happened to his first wife, but I don't even recall. I don't think she was Yogeshwar's mother. T.R. Yogeshwar, you know, their system of naming children is different from ours. It's the first T stands for Triplicane, which is where he was born, and the S of S.R. Ranganathan is Shiali, which is where Ranganathan was born. Then the second is there as far, so his name is Triplicane Ranganathan Yogeshwar. So he's always known as T.R. Yogeshwar in the Western fashion. So Yogeshwar is, in fact, if you were a Christian, it would be his Christian name. Yes. Excellent fellow. Very, very nice chap. Very well balanced and well adjusted to his father. His fame, his international status. He was a research professor at one of the 12 in India. And which for the library profession was a tremendous honour, almost like being a member of the Order of Merit here. And yes, as I say, but he was great fun to be with, and would always listen and take note carefully, and he was great one for the early morning before breakfast walk. I did that several times with him during the Dorking conference. Got up early to have a walk round the place before breakfast.
Did he wear a Western dress, or did he wear a dress?
No, never.
What was it?
Always, always, yes. Yeah.
So let's go on then to, I suppose, the Dorking Conference is in a very, it's a milestone. In the
Well, it is, because we got, as I said, Jean Garfield was there. Helen Brownson was there, and she at that time was something to do with the Ford Foundation, I believe.
Or at NSF?
Was it?
I'm not sure.
Well, she was to do with giving out money.
NSF, I think.
Oh, NSF. Oh, yes.
I think she, you know, published those,
Yes. And Barbara Kyle, of course, ought to mention Barbara, who was a dear friend of mine and died much too soon. Mm. And she was the social sciences person in the CRG and did a lot of work on analysing the social sciences, seeing whether our theory of integrative levels would fit in with the social sciences. I firmly believe it does throughout, though I've many an argument with Derek Langridge over that.
Tell me what the theory of integrative levels is.
Well, it's very similar to general systems theory, though it goes back a long way further, to a paper by Joseph Needham, who was the great China expert at Cambridge before the war. He published a book of essays called Time, the Refreshing River. And in it was this theory of integrative levels, which was that, very much like facet analysis, that individual items or entities form relationships with one another, and by virtue of those relationships they can combine to form one entity which is greater than all of them, but which consists of all of them and their relationships, nothing else. Like the example, crude example I use is of a bicycle. A bicycle, basically, you could start with bits of rubber and metal and so forth, And out of those, you can make a pedal. You can also make a wheel. So you get a pedal and a wheel, and with a bit of steel you can make bars and things. And you, all of these you can lie on the ground as separate entities. Each one does nothing much except be itself until it's put into relationship, a permanent relationship with something else. Mm. Like the pedal goes with the axle, and the axle goes with the wheel, and the wheel goes with the frame. And when you've put all these things, these separate entities together, they make a machine for transferring rotary motion to horizontal motion. So you get the whole bicycle. And of course, in the classification, in the classification of bicycle manufacture, the bicycle is the personality.
Okay.
And iron and steel and rubber and plastic, for what I know, are the materials. Nuts and bolts are the parts. And those, the various categories, these things drop naturally into various categories. And that's what general systems theory is, that they talk in abstract terms of wholes and entities in relationship, which make new wholes, which by virtue of the relationship between them make the whole more than the sum of its parts. So once you destroy the relationships, you're just left with a heap of parts with no personality at this level. But at the level below, each one of those parts is its own personality. And so there you come. I apply this in, I think that I demonstrate, I've got a piece of paper that I can, you can spare, and I demonstrate this in classes. Now, well, there was a second 50 years after, a few years ago.
Why was the Dorking Conference so important, do you think?
Well, I think it was the first time that a group of individuals like those people, each known as ploughing a furrow of their, almost of their own invention, without perhaps knowing that there were others a lot working in the same area, got together. They were, we selected them, and we didn't always get the right people. Helen Brownson said that we made a big mistake in the United States chap. I forget who he was, but she said you ought to have had the IBM man. Goodness. Oh dear.
Who was the American chap?
You know, I can't remember, but he was a very nice chap, but he wasn't at all contributory to the final. Well, I could even get that, because I expect that's one of the things. I've lost some of my books in the move, I'm afraid.
That's easy to look at.
I've got that one, I'm sure. Yeah, so Helen Brownson was there, de Croliet was there, Cordonnier, who had done stuff in the war for the French Ministry of one of the industries, an engineer he was. It was very small. Beric Sayers came and opened the conference.
He'd be very old.
He was very old by then. In fact, he only lasted a year or two longer than that. And
Pauline, was she the reporter or something? Pauline Cochrane?
Pauline did something, yes. De Grolier gave the final general sort of report, analytical report of the conference.
Well, I missed talking to him. He died apparently a couple of years ago.
Oh, did he? Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Maybe we were wondering about that.
with the microwaves the other day.
I think so. I think Sylvie Fier Scribe, who was doing work, acknowledged him and his contribution in something or other. And then I think somebody said he died. So it might have only been a year ago or 2 years.
But how awful that we didn't see that.
Well, I didn't see any obituary notices.
No, neither did I.
And you'd think you would, because he was so...
Yeah.
You know, well known.
Oh, absolutely.
For such a long time, you know.
He was one of the best bowmen in the world. Because he dabbled in so many fields.
And had been since the war, too. I mean, it was a long, you know...
Yes, but of course he was famous in bibliographical circles in the 30s. Yeah. He had been, he told me he had been to one of the first conferences in around 1932, bibliographical conferences, which involved people from the USSR. Mm. And...
Because I think he was also active in the creation of UFOP, the Union...
Union Française des Organismes de la Documentation.
Yes. UFOP. Yeah. So, I mean, yes, he...
I went to see de Gaulier and Ranganathan.
Now, that would be
one another. That really was...
Oh, so they actually had encounters?
Oh, they had it. Oh, certainly, because both were at the Dawkins Conference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So how did that work?
Well... You mean the conference or the confrontation?
No, the confrontation, but they couldn't be more different, you think.
Well, they didn't really ever clash.
Mm.
They seemed to accept the other's point of view, and as a sort of, like a little child sort of thing, they will do it. And de Gaulier was always very firm that the Ranganathan's principles did not accord with Cartesian principles. That's, as a Frenchman, I'm naturally Cartesian, I'm an insane more than once. And so he found it difficult to accept this, I was going to say materialist. That wouldn't be the right word, because de Gaulier was a materialist himself. But it was a different way, in a way very pragmatic, whereas de Gaulier wanted to be philosophical in sort of academic terms.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, from my, you know, McCarthyan
background,
one of the accusations that Metcalf used to make of Ranganathan was that he was not merely theoretical but mystical, and that he carried things into a level that was completely unrelated to the practical reality.
Mm. Yes, well, that certainly wasn't true.
Yeah.
And but he was not of the European academic philosophical analysis traditions like Descartes and the Leibniz and the Dutchman. Schopenhauer as well, but Spinoza particularly. And he did have this, I suppose. I could never take Ranganathan as a mystic, when I, knowing him as I did quite well. But he did have this class in the colon classification, which was called something like mysticism, right in the middle. And he also had the inclination to codify processes a bit in relation to layers of spirituality, put it like his Abhupa pattern, like I've forgotten what they relate the word, what the APUPA mean, but it's, they used to describe it like the onion.
Yeah.
the outer skin of the onion looks like that, and you think, well, that's an onion, and then you peel off the layer and you've still got an onion, but it's not the same onion.
Mm-hmm.
And so on until right you get to the heart of the matter, like I've written down there. And that is the essence and the truth, which is, I suppose, in mystical terms, is given by revelation or intuition, like the idealist philosophers from Plato onwards, by intuition rather than by dirtying your hand at it.
Yeah.
But in practice, as I said earlier, the subject specialist could always cut non-professional analysis like anything. More than once people have said to me, well, why don't all libraries use this kind of arrangement? It's so simple.
Well, I suppose in one sense, classification, like the doing classification, is increasingly classified.
Yes, but that's conscious.
Yes.
Yeah, they took that decision in the Library of Congress. But then, of course, Dewey always had this.
Yes, he did.
Synthesis. It wasn't systematic.
No.
But it was very much the same approach as we had when we were talking about having to develop a new general classification. But there's no point in writing out everything more than once.
Mm.
So with Dewey, basically it was simple geographical and historical subdivision.
Yes.
But there are plenty of other occasions, right in the first edition, where he says divide like somewhere else.
Mm.
I always give the example, strikes in the mining industry, which perhaps were occurring in 1876.